Welcome to Passion to Power with your host, Michelle Zeitlin. She's a creative producer who quote-unquote wears many hats. She's also a talent and literary manager and founded the company Morzap Productions and Management. She develops people and projects across all media. Her guests encompass the gamut, from artists to authors, actors to activists. Please welcome Michelle Zeitlin, Passion to Power.
It is my privilege and honor to have John Frank Levy. Mind you, I've had some Levy's, so let's spell his name, L-E-V-E-Y. And not only do I know John as a talent manager, but I know John, and he may not remember this, as an actress, because I've been in this business for over 3 decades, and I was on Broadway, and I was in television, and I was in film, and I remember very distinctly walking into the ominous John Levy casting director room and immediately feeling really valued. And I wanted to tell you this. I felt so valued. I felt like you got me all of the work and investment, because at that time we had agents who did not work on breakdowns. It was a big deal to pick up the phone and pitch your client and then go into the room and meet the casting director. And John, I always felt you had tremendous respect for actors. So I wanted to start the interview that way.
And well, I appreciate that very much. You know, that's kind of the best compliment you can give a casting director, is that you felt supported in their room, because I think actors have a misconception that we're somehow the wall between them and the job. And for both practical and artistic reasons, we want you to succeed. We are not an obstacle to you. We are a doorway.
I totally felt that. And I also felt your staff, everyone that ever worked for you, your assistants, were very much respectful of the process and respectful of the actor's time. And not everybody is. I know you say casting directors in general want to support actors and have good intentions, but from an actor's point of view, very often you feel rushed through the process and you do all this preparation. So I really felt there was a great value. I also wanted to share with you that way back when you were first casting the pilot for Shameless, one of my actors went to producers. He's now become a visual artist. His name is Chase Bisson. I think he was competing against Cameron Monaghan at the time, and Cameron was absolutely the right choice. I wanted you to go back and talk a little bit about your start. You've been in this business, I understand, over 35 years. You've cast some of our biggest shows, John Wells, ER, you've worked on Animal Kingdom, most recently SEAL Team, of course, Shameless Forever.
Finding the community that you can join to participate in a collaborative, respectful way, so that you can find the role that you're right for, whether you're an actor or whether you're an art director or a caterer or whatever. If you can do your job with the fullness of yourself, you can contribute to excellence. And I've had the incredibly great good fortune to have that opportunity many times. I'm proud to say that I did my part, did my job, and found the role that I was right for, and have had a chance to be a collaborator.
I absolutely agree you are a collaborator, because I think when a showrunner is working on a show, and many people don't know this, they are literally like a chicken with their head cut off. They have to have 8 arms. They're doing so many things. So they need to know that that person who is scouting talent, making deals with talent agencies, and reaching out not only has a mental Rolodex, but also has the relationships that they can trust that you can do it, and then they can meet that talent at an elite level.
Absolutely. And really, that's not just true of the casting director. It's the head of every department has to be able to be right for their role and do their job with the same collaborative dedication and therefore contribute to the whole. The whole is greater than the sum of the parts.
And your biggest shows have been ensemble shows.
Absolutely. And my I enjoy that balancing act of, you know, I think I talk about in the book, my childhood memory of making mobiles on the beach in Martha's Vineyard out of seashells and driftwood. And I always thought of casting a pilot in the same kind of balancing aesthetic way. You know, if you have George Clooney and then you have Anthony Edwards and then you have Eric LaSalle and then you have Noah Wiley as your four leading men, you have excellence at every corner and beauty at every corner.
And I noticed that Eric also did a lovely testimonial for your book. Well, let me talk about the book. It's called Right for the Role: Breakdowns, Breakups, and Breakthroughs, a great alliteration from 35 years of casting iconic TV shows. Well, I would say those are iconic TV shows, and you become an icon yourself, John.
Well, that's embarrassing.
Living icons. You know, a lot of the people I interview on my podcast are the showrunners, the programming executives, the people behind the scenes. And I think actors very often feel they're so alone in their preparation. I wanted you to talk a little bit about the preparation now, how it's so different from the days of just a few years ago. Most of the actors now are initially self-taping, not doing pre-reads. What are the upsides and downsides of that for you?
Well, which one would you like me to start with? I have strong opinions. The upside, of course, is that I can see more people. All of technology has streamlined the processes that whatever job the technology is being applied to requires. And so it's more convenient. You don't have to drive across town. I don't have to corral my writer, producer, director into my office for a 3-hour period of time during a hectic and busy prep period. Each audition takes about a tenth the time of a live audition would, because there's nothing in between the audition. That said, we're in the business of telling the stories of human beings, and we're doing it now without much human contact. And I, for one, miss the human contact, because I learned so much about you between the scenes, between the lines, in the waiting room, when I introduced you to the directors. All of those moments are lost.
You said exactly what I've always felt, not only as an actress, but also as a talent rep, that who you are in a room is so much about your authenticity. And you get that first and foremost before you ever start the audition.
Absolutely. You get it in the waiting room. You know, the way people behave when they're sitting there, it's as if they're at the dentist's office. For some people, their fear and loathing is going on. And then there are other people who are busy trying to distract each other with humor and absurdity. And you learn a lot about people watching them interact with their competitors and with their friends and then with me and my colleagues. It's a job application. We're going to spend time with you on the set. I may not join you on the set, but the director wants to know that your performance is going to be great, but he also wants to know that you're a collaborator, that you're a willing participant, that you won't be, you won't be disruptive in any way, and that you won't be, that you'll be oil in the machine as opposed to friction in the machine.
Well said. And I'm sure you have experience with parents of kids too, right? When you're having to cast children, what's that like?
Well, you know, in the old days when we had live auditions, often the parents of the kids would program their children to behave in a certain way that would rob them of anything authentic or spontaneous you know, are real, and they would come in and they would be like automatons or marionettes, and their parents were in the room with them. And I always tried to put them at ease and take that away from them and, you know, let them do it the way their mother told them to once, and then free them of the responsibility to do it the way their mother told them to do it, and to have them do it the way they feel it. You know, a million years ago, I taught acting classes for teenagers. And I went into it thinking, oh, this is going to be great. They're the freest group of people in the world. But of course, I was totally wrong. They're the most uptight group of people in the world because they haven't yet got a sense of who they actually are. So right. They don't have any authentic touchstone to rely on. They're so being formed. And you know, I knew when I was in my early 20s and wanted to be an actor, I had some of the right attributes. I'm smart and I'm funny and I wasn't bad looking, but I didn't have enough of a clear sense of who I was. So I didn't have a real handle on a toolbox that I could access. And that is so important for any artist, really any person, because we're all on a kind of a journey of self-actualization or self-awareness, and the more we accomplish that, the more we have to draw on whatever our line of work is.
We have a fun thing to do now, John. We have three actors at different stages of their career. We have one in a right-to-work market in Nashville who will be here in LA very soon. We have one in New York who's a graduate of Tisch, and we have one that you met through emails who happens to also be a playwright, an award-winning playwright and writer, Julia. I'm gonna let them in now, and they've each prepared a question, and I would love for you to share with these actors at different stages some really great kernels of gold. Let me let them in. So I would love for you, John, to be just really frank as you are, and Frank is your middle name, and share those kernels of gold, because we have actors of all stages that listen to this podcast around the world, primarily in the US, Canada, and the UK. Julia, let's start with you.
Hello, good morning.
Hi, Julia. I'm afraid any kernels I have will be kernels of silver, not gold.
I'll take any kernels. I had a question about something about the casting process. You've done multiple ensemble shows, you know, ER, Shameless. Now, I know when there are two romantic leads, you'll do a chemistry read. Do you ever do chemistry reads for families or ensembles? How do you make sure that your characters are going to have that spark on screen, even if it's not a romantic one?
Well, you know, if nobody has the job yet, I really love chemistry reads. Mm-hmm. But when somebody has the job, I'm really not in love with chemistry reads, because then, an actor might not have a good instinct about who she has chemistry with. Mm-hmm. I believe that two good actors can create chemistry, whether it's the kind of chemistry that is romantic and sexual that brings the two characters together, or whether it's the kind of chemistry that creates friction and conflict, which is often necessary between two characters. So, I think that your question is really important, but I'm not sure that there's one answer for it. You know, during the casting of Shameless, we often included Emmy Rossum in the process of the various lovers and men in her life. And who she favored wasn't always who the producers wanted to use. And then you had an opportunity, or you maybe lost an opportunity to create chemistry because she was disappointed that it wasn't the other guy.
Gotcha.
Did I answer your question?
You did. Oh, no, 100%. That's fascinating. I hadn't even thought about what happens when you already have somebody in place. So thank you so much for sharing that.
Julia, I had just said the very same thing, that his real talent has been in drawing together incredible ensembles, not only through the pilot, but through the many years of series. And many of his shows have gone on to play for what? How many seasons was ER?
15. We did, you know, it was just unbelievable. 330 something episodes. And instead of doing, you know, ER Toledo, followed by ER Tulsa, followed by ER Miami, we just kept revolving the cast in and out. And so it always stayed in Chicago. And the ER itself was the main star. And then new people came and brought new characteristics and personalities and new conflicts and new loves and, you know, new triumphs and new tragedies. And I always felt that that was the best way to do it. I know, you know, some of the procedurals have done new versions in other towns, and it's worked very well for them. But I'm very proud of how ER kept molting and evolving. Shameless was on for 11 seasons. I've been privileged to work on long-running shows, which is really exciting because the evolution of the characters really has an opportunity to happen.
And speaking to that chemistry, Julia, you know, you're watching a kid start. I don't know how old those kids were on Shameless when they started, but they become teenagers and young adults.
Yeah, they learned. They went to the best acting school you could possibly go to. W.H. Macy telling them what's going on in the scene, and Emmy Rossum and Steve Howie, and those kids grew up. They were the youngest, you know, Ethan Kukowski and Emma were, Emma Kenny, were 8 and 9 when we started, and they were 19 and 20 when we ended. Imagine going through adolescence on a show like Shameless.
Ah! Right? And I remember that room because, as I said, I had a colleague and client who was up for a series role. And I remember I drove him. I picked him up from the airport for his producer callback. And people were outside smoking and chatting and that nervous pacing. Julian James, do you have a question?
I do. I was going to ask you, we haven't spoken about it yet. I was going to ask you about casting the drama series Animal Kingdom, because not only is it a lot of younger folks and lesser knowns, but it's really, really heavy and really violent material off the bat. It's super weighty stuff. So I'm wondering what's something that those people, those actors brought to the material that impressed you, and sort of if you could speak to the process of finding that family.
Well, thank you. That's a great question. You know, each television show has its own requirements, its own necessities. When we were doing ER, everybody needed to at least have that heroic quality that we've rediscovered during the pandemic that the medical profession has.
Yeah.
On Animal Kingdom, everybody had to have a certain fuck-upness.
Yeah.
These characters had complicated, difficult childhoods, and a matriarch who was manipulative and sexualizing, and who made them behave. You know, most of our parents told us to have good manners and do the right thing and help old ladies across the street and clean up things we spilled and all of that. And this mother told their kids that everything was about winning and about triumphing and about threatening and about abusing, as she abused them. And so each of these characters needed to have a willingness to go to a place inside themselves that wasn't lovely and that was potentially dangerous and that was fraught with complexity, and that was what we were looking for, and thankfully we found it.
And speaking to that, Julian actually had an audition this week where he had to play a real SOB, a young Marine, and I'm like, oh my god, you're a friggin' psychopath, and he goes, I love it.
Yeah, there's nothing like getting that permission to just, you know, you can act a little unhinged.
Yeah, but it takes bravery to do it with authenticity, because you have to access, like any part, you have to access the parts of yourself and that are your experience and your imagination that are applicable to the role, so that you can what if yourself into the circumstances of the character with authenticity and reality. And, you know, most of us would rather run down the street with no clothes on than reveal our darker, most unpleasant aspects. Although lots of actors do agree with you that there's a lot of fun to be had giving yourself permission to release the worst parts of yourself.
Yeah. Thanks, Sean.
There's parts of
Thank
who
you.
Aren't, thankfully. We don't all have to do Stanislavski digging from who we are. We can also imagine. Gabe is coming out to LA for a very unique experience. He's an American Ninja Warrior athlete, a classical cellist, and a singer-songwriter. Gabe, what's your question?
Hi. Good to talk with you, John. I am newer to the industry and have only known the realm of self-tape auditions. And so I'm just curious for your experience, John, having been in the industry for seeing so many different phases of, I guess, auditioning and casting talent. What is your experience with self-tapes being, you know, a really prominent and main part of casting now? Do you enjoy it? Do you feel like it's been a good shift to it, or what's your experience been like with it now?
We talked about it a little bit earlier. I'm an interactive being, so for me, there's a great deal that's good and convenient about it, there's more that's lost. And by the way, I don't think you're new, Gabe, to our industry, because if you have the discipline and creativity and motivation to be a cellist and a ninja athlete, you've already demonstrated that you have a lot of what it takes to succeed here. Not to mention that we're in a period of time where Lorraine Hansberry, who said to be young, gifted, and Black. Well, today, that's a giant asset, finally.
Thanks.
I was going to speak to diversity because Shameless was one of those breakout, breakthrough shows, like you've used in your title of your book, to really embrace diversity in a way that just didn't have to be on the page. You cast some actors unexpectedly. Can you speak to that?
Well, you know, I mean, I think actually, Michelle, it goes back to ER, which was before it diversity and inclusion and all of that authenticity, all of those buzzwords became mandated because of social pressure. While it's true that Eric LaSalle was the only regular of color at the beginning, we added regulars of color, Asians, Asian Americans, Latin Americans, and African Americans during the course of the show. And also the fabric of the show had diversity built into it, both in the patient community and in the nurses and emergency medical technicians and the other hospital staff members. And it was before we were being told to do it. We did it because it was right for the story and because we knew from our leader, John Wells, and from all of our own conviction that if you were telling a story that took place in urban Chicago, where people didn't have primary medical care other than the emergency room, those people were going to be uninsured and poor. And often in our country, in cities like Chicago, poor people are people of color.
John loves actors.
I do. You're magicians. It's fantastic. I've had a seat 7 feet away from you for more than 35 years, and I got paid to watch miracles happen.
So thank you so much for speaking so honestly and sharing with these actors. One of the mandates of my agency is triple threatism. Because I was an actress, singer, dancer, started as a dancer, moved into acting and finally singing when I had a knee injury and I had to embrace the fact that I had to be a better singer. And everyone on this screen is a triple threat. Can you speak to the special skills on a resume, what you look for and how much that matters when you bring somebody in?
Well, your training and your experience matter more than your special skills. Your special skills, when they're applicable to the necessities of the role, become important. You know, if I need somebody who can be a ninja warrior, then that training and that skill set is of value. If I need someone to do a cello solo with Yo-Yo Ma, then that is important information.
Well, that would be a dream.
Pretty ideal.
Yo-Yo Ma.
He appeared on an episode of The West Wing, playing the cello, of course. So special skills become important as they directly relate to the necessities of the character. If I directed a play in town where the leading lady was a retired ballerina, and there was a moment in the play where she danced with her nephew, who was a present ballet dancer. And so both of those people needed to have that skill. During the course of Shameless, we had to have people who were comfortable with nudity. That was a skill that was necessary. All of those things become important when they directly relate to the role. I like to tell the story. There was one actress, and I can't remember who it was, but we asked her, this scene requires simulated sex. Are you comfortable with that? And she said, oh, well, simulated sex is the only sex I've had in years.
That's the best answer. Did she rate it? Was it PG?
Not at all.
Oh my goodness. All right. Well, I wanted to turn it over to each actor to talk about where they're located in general. I know today Julian is on the West Coast, but he's usually in New York. And talk a little bit about the casting process in different locations, because as you know, John, there's incentives to cast in certain markets, produce in certain markets, shoot in certain markets. Julia, I wanted to ask you about the recent Oscars. One of the interviews I did was with a colleague and friend named Vincent Patterson, who's an award-winning choreographer, director, and he also put out a book. And his frustration has been that choreographers have not been acknowledged by the Academy. There's no category. Of course, you would probably be frustrated with the fact that we also have not acknowledged casting directors. Can you speak to that a bit?
I was very thrilled this year because a number of people posted and reposted on Instagram the names of the casting directors who were responsible for putting together the ensembles that were nominated for Best Picture and Best Actor, Best Supporting Actor, et cetera. And I thought that was a wonderful gesture. Along with Junie Lowry Johnson, that's harder to say than it seems, and her office, shared the first Emmy Award for casting. And that was a great honor and a great thrill. And someday that will happen for choreographers and that will happen for casting directors in the Academy. And why it hasn't happened yet is a travesty and a mystery.
I reached out and gave a woot woot to Julie Ashton, and she was so touched. She said, thank you, my friend, because often casting directors don't feel acknowledged. And since we're usually hitting up casting directors to see our people, it's really nice to do something that is selfless and really acknowledges your talent. Danielle O'Fierro, woot woot to you too. Great people that should be acknowledged.
John, I'm curious, what is maybe one of your most memorable casting experiences? Whatever makes it memorable?
There are a million of them. Literally there's almost a million auditions that I've sat in on. You know, some of the most memorable, I think I've told this story once or twice on other interview situations, but during the AIDS epidemic in Los Angeles on ER, we cast an HIV positive AIDS patient, and we decided to be authentic. And I called the LA gay and lesbian organization that I was aware of at the time and asked if they were aware of any actors who were members of their community who would be comfortable revealing that they were HIV positive and or had AIDS and also were talented enough to play the part. And we saw a lot of young men who came into the office, and one guy in particular was just so moving and spectacular that we all were, you know, impressed and moved. And I said to him, that was fantastic, man. Thanks so much for your generous performance. And he said, when is this gonna work? And I said, well, you know, I think today's Tuesday. I think it shoots a week from tomorrow. And he said, my T cell count is zero. I likely won't be alive a week from tomorrow. One of the greatest gifts a casting director can have is to learn and grow of themselves and have experiences in communities that they aren't part of or don't know much about, and therefore expand their empathy and their knowledge of the world.
Hi, my name is Julia Steyer.
Hi, my name is Julian James.
What's going on, y'all? My name is Gabe Baker.
Oh, I like that one. How about you, John?
John Frank Levy. John Frank Levy. John Frank Levy.
And what's your slate?
Hello, everybody. John Frank Levy here.
Everybody, get this book.
I would be remiss if I didn't also mention the woman who wrote the book with me. Her name is Trudy Roth, and without her, there would be no book. She researched me and my life and my career. She organized me, and she gave me the bravery to reveal myself in the book. And I think if the book is successful, and so far it's been beyond my wildest imagination, if the book is successful, it's because it's both professional and personal.
The best books are. I'm a talent and literary agent, and I've walked a lot of people through their writing their autobiographies and their books with resources, and the best books start with yourself. The best stories start with ourselves, and I think that's a great analogy and close. Actors, we start with our authentic self when we introduce ourselves. Who you are is the most important part of your performance. And I wanted to ask you one more question, John. Currently,
interrupt you for a moment and say, yeah. Who you are becoming is the most important part of your career.
True that. Some people want the actor slate at the beginning. Some people want the actor slate at the back. Do you have a preference on why?
I think it should be at the beginning so that it most resembles the introduction that would have happened in the room.
I like that too. And I always tell my actors, you're 85% there if you're likable. So just be yourself and engage, and then just dive into the words, because it's all a seamless representation of your performance.
I agree. Being on a journey to find the role that you're right for involves having disregard for your comfort zone so that you can have as big a toolbox as you might be able to get from your experience and your imagination.
So thanks very much for listening to this episode, and please share all the episodes with your friends and colleagues. We appreciate your ratings and comments on Apple Podcasts and on social media. If you'd like more information about our programs and our special people and projects, please access www.morezap.com, More Zap Productions for Talent and Literary. And if you'd like to book a special one-on-one coaching or a group clinic or workshop, please access passion-power.com, and you can fill out our form there and make a request. Thanks again.